This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Isaac Stone Fish is the author of America Second, his new book, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger. The politicians are not well paid, but they're certainly in the news all the time. The celebrities are extremely well paid, and they're in the news when they make political statements. Richard Gere, one of the great Hollywood romantic stars of the 20th century. I learned from Isaac that Richard Gere disappeared from my understanding of who's a big star because he's a man of principle. The principle for Richard Gere was Tibet. And what do we know, Isaac, about China reaching out and crushing or delimiting Richard Gere's career?
In the early 90s, Richard Gere gave a very moving, very quixotic speech at the Oscars, criticizing Deng Xiaoping, the then leader of China, for the occupation of Tibet and asking for consciousness towards what was happening. And that and the recent awakening of ideas about the Dalai Lama in Hollywood led to this period where in the mid-90s, the cause in Hollywood was Tibet. And the feel-good celebrity was the Dalai Lama, and Richard Gere was his most prominent supporter. And this happened until 1996, 1997, the high point of the movement. Those three films we discussed before, Kundun, Red Corner, 7 years in Tibet. And Beijing realized that they could convince Hollywood to stop making films that had portrayals of China that they found critical. And it didn't happen overnight. And Gere's career didn't die overnight. It was a long, sophisticated, secretive process. But what happened by the mid-2010s was Hollywood executives had developed this voice in the back of their head, which would say, is this going to offend China? Is this going to offend the Chinese Communist Party? If so, we're not going to do it. The last film that I was able to find from Hollywood, the last major film that had anything in it critical of China, was The Departed, which came out, I believe, in 2013, 2014. Matt Damon, Jack Nicholson, Chinese bad guys playing a very, very small role. But that was it. And today, you can't find negative or even critical portrayals of Chinese. And this is sad, not only from a freedom of speech perspective, but it's also very denigrating to portray a type of person in only one way. I'm Jewish, and if every Jewish character in a movie was a successful doctor or a lawyer, and people were saying, oh gosh, need to get my Jewish doctor in here, I would find that very offensive. And that is a parallel to how Hollywood portrays Chinese people today.
You ask a very difficult question in your book. When is it appropriate to self-censor? When you were 17 years old, you traveled to China. Your parents are very bold. Good for them, Isaac. Where did you go and what did you see when you were 17?
My first trip to China in 2001 was in Xinjiang, the northwest region close to Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, where today Beijing is committing a genocide against its own people. Back then, I grew up pretty sheltered. I don't like to admit that out loud, but I saw a different way of being. It was a very eye-opening experience for me. I saw a country, and again, this sounds trite, but the country is so vast, there would always be things that I would be interested in. The next summer, I went back to Tibet. I took a summer off and backpacked through India. But then every summer after that, I think I spent about almost 10 summers in a row in China. And I'd lived in Beijing for 6 years and tried to wrap my head around the place.
So this is the Isaac Stone Fish taboo career. That's where you've been. You've only touched taboos. Now, I bring up Xinjiang because we talked about the three T's, Taiwan, Tiananmen, and Tibet. But Xinjiang is also a major, major crisis, worldwide crisis, because it's an ongoing genocide. That's an official word from several administrations, and it's a word that is endorsed by major media. Ongoing now, and yet, when is it appropriate to self-censor? Now, the puzzle here isn't just Hollywood. It's also corporations. You list some of them in the course of these last 20, 22 years, IBM and Boeing and Marriott firing an employee. I a hourly wage employee because he retweeted a reference to the country called Taiwan. However, in this self-censorship, what you explicate here is that it ranges from the academy, the university campus, all the way to the sports teams, especially the NBA. That happened before the pandemic, so we need to recover it. A man who was part of the Houston Rockets tweeted something about Hong Kong, and what happened to him, Isaac?
So it was the general manager of the Houston Rockets at the time, Daryl Morey, tweeted and then deleted something supporting Hong Kong. And there was this huge outcry from Beijing, not because Beijing is so sensitive that they can't handle someone supporting Hong Kong, but because they chose to make an example of the NBA. And the NBA's business standing in China torpedoed almost overnight. And instead of NBA players really standing up and saying, great, freedom of expression, there were a lot of voices that were critical of Morey for doing this. The most prominent of them being from LeBron James, perhaps the biggest star of the NBA, a very well-known Trump critic who criticized Morey for speaking out for freedom in Hong Kong and democracy and human rights in Hong Kong. And it was just such a perfect moment of hypocrisy for many people in the United States, especially those on the right, because LeBron James, very, very critical of Trump, often very deservedly so, but criticizing a fellow NBAer for speaking out against an injustice is a bitter pill for a lot of people to swallow.
So what we see here is that China's gone from the supplicant with Henry Kissinger in 1971 and then the Mao to the beseecher after Tiananmen Square, beseeching America to be more careful with the way it presents China, to a bully, an ability to reach out and slap people down. We don't actually believe that China contacted LeBron James. They didn't have to. That's a form of it's a sophisticated form of self-censorship. Not only not speaking of China's conduct in Hong Kong, for heaven's sakes, compared to what they're doing in Xinjiang, Hong Kong is, a reversal of gentrification. It's abusive. It's the death of a major city, but it's not genocide. At the same time, China now, by the date that it's 2018 is what I have in my notes when this happened, China's emboldened. What is the right understanding that it believes now it doesn't have to hesitate? It doesn't need an interlocutor. It can do this on its own.
I think it's had such great success with interlocutors, with these bridges, with friends. And I think the point you brought up about LeBron James is a really good one. It's highly unlikely that anyone from China called LeBron and said, hey, say this, say that. He was just so well trained in the quote unquote niceties of how you should speak about China that Beijing likes. And we've seen this time and time again with entertainment stars, with movie stars, with former politicians, with business leaders. And one thing that's very heartening about the period we're in now, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit later, is that some of this veil of censorship is lifted. But I do feel like self-censorship is such a common phenomenon, both in my own way of speaking about China, even today, even on this interview, and before. And I think people, it's sort of like the word propaganda. People have way too narrow of an understanding of censorship and self-censorship and think, oh, it doesn't happen here. It just happens in Russia and China. Same thing with propaganda. They think, the political party I don't like puts out propaganda, as opposed to understanding the intimate ties between political speech and propaganda and being arguably the same side of the same coin.
In 2012, the Chinese leadership went from the fourth generation to the fifth, from Hu Jintao to Xi Jinping. And that looks like an important day to me, Isaac, reading, because that's when China issued permission to Hollywood to release 48 films a year. We know now, 10 years later, that Xi Jinping is a very strong-minded leader, planning to continue his time as general secretary in the elections forthcoming. Do you sense there was a degree change after Xi, that the evolving of the wolf warrior comes out of this period between 2012 and 2022, that China all of a sudden understood its power and was expressing it?
I do. And it's always so hard to know in history. Is it the great men or the great moments or the terrible men and the terrible moments that shaped the currents? I feel like a lot changed when she took power, and then especially in 2018, when three things happened. One was we started getting credible reports about the genocide in Xinjiang. Two was she moving away, abolished, I would say is perhaps even too strong of a term, but moving away from the term limits for the chairmanship of the country and solidifying in people's minds that he wanted to upend, you know, a decade or two of progress towards more systematic power transitions in the Chinese system. And also the awakening of this idea that if we don't do anything, China will become the world's most powerful country. And with Xi growing increasingly authoritarian, and with Beijing increasingly seeming like it doesn't need input from the rest of the world in the same way, Americans starting to ask the question, is that what we want? And if not, what are we going to do about it?
I think an opera is worthwhile here. My notes say in 2012, Xi was at luncheon with the head of Disney, Mr. Iger, his colleague, Mr. Katzenberg, and their colleague, Henry Kissinger. A luncheon is my note here. At that point, how did Xi present himself? That I'm going to be a friend of America. I understand America. I've lived here. I've traveled here. Was he seen as a change of weather for the better by these cultural superstars?
He was. And Hu Jintao, his predecessor, was such a wooden apparatchik that the Queen of England reportedly said that Hu was the most boring man she'd ever met. Xi Jinping had a personality. He could smile in a natural way. He could shake hands. He could do some of the retail politicianing. And there wasn't a sense of what this would mean in terms of market access, in terms of repression, in terms of national security threats to the United States. And it's so difficult to know how much of that were foregone conclusions and how much of that was Xi's responding to domestic and international currents. But hindsight being it's 2020 as it is, we see now that Xi was taking the country in a very, very dangerous direction.
You're right that Hollywood's come up with ways to deal with China. You're only permitted to show it in a positive light and not just a couple of shots. It has to be an extensive positive light. I wrote down three ways. It's unfortunate that that Hollywood has turned to antagonists from the Ummah as opposed to anyone from East Asia. The movies have become comic book-like. That is, you understand, the Fantastic Four. Chinese are only presented as valorous, only valorous. Now, if people think about it, they can say, oh, yes, but the whole idea of using Hollywood and TV to a lesser extent, you make it clear that TV hasn't been all that persuaded yet. The whole idea is that you're changing people's opinions of China without actually them knowing it. Is that what China thinks they can do?
And they've been remarkably accurate in their thinking. The idea of going to sea with a borrowed boat, as a Chinese expression has it, how do we use what Hollywood has done in order to propagate the ideas that we want spread? It's been remarkably, remarkably successful.
We come now to the third decade of the 21st century. The book is America Second, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger. Isaac Stone Fish is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.